Welcome to Imaginarium, an alternate history of art, a podcast where we delve into the most obscure parts of art history. Hello, dear listeners. I'm your host, Najah. And in this podcast, we try to shed light on less studied parts of the history of art and visual culture. In today's episode, we'll dive into the nebulous world of selling and buying fine art. But most importantly, we'll talk about art heists, forgeries, and art fakes. We'll try to lift the curtain, if even just a bit, on a world that is most mysterious to those who are not in it. When we think of this mysterious world, there is not much we know for certain from the outside looking in. Something that is being done on purpose to keep an air of mystique and exclusivity to that realm. Prices are attributed to objects or paintings. People with a lot of money show up and buy them at sums that are absolutely exorbitant for most people. After all, only a fraction of us can afford to buy a genuine painting or Matisse. And even if they could, there is a limited quantity of paintings that have been created, which adds to the exclusivity and sentiment of scarcity. Auction houses can sell many a thing, from art to furniture to jewelry and cutlery. And these can be available to everyone who might want to purchase something. And yet, even when they are public, they still feel off-limits to the masses, as if the intricacies of it are closed off to the rest of us, mere mortals. And while anyone can go to an estate sale or purchase a nice desk at a regional auction, there are certain auction houses such as Sotheby's and Christie's, which are known globally for their extremely rare objects and art. The way the world of selling art works, well, at least, the world of fine art, is one that relies a lot on status, exclusivity, and exclusion. While other fields and disciplines of art, such as illustration, for example, relies on prints and copies, ensuing an accessible and reliable supply of material. You can print a work of art again and again, and sell it to as many people as you might want to. And that is the goal of it, to be copied and seen times and times again. Meanwhile, when it comes to fine art, it relies on there being one unique example of the piece of art. The value of the Mona Lisa simply would not be the same if there were infinite copies of it, all made from the hand of Leonardo da Vinci. It is the fact that it is considered to be one of the most precious and most well-known works of art, and it is the only one. It is the only one that had been specifically made by that artist's hand, and that was created by those materials and paints only available during the early 16th century. And so for that reason, and myriad of other that can be discerning, and some of which are more obscure, it got established in the cultural consciousness as an extremely precious and worthy work of art. When it comes to status in society, art has always played an incredible role in the way the elites have shown their wealth and position in society. And this is arguably a very simplistic way of looking at it. Social spheres and dynamics are incredibly complex and subtle in a lot of ways. In ages past, the social hierarchy was as complex. However, knowing where one belonged on the ladder was easier than it is now. I think personally that works of art should be appreciated on their own, without any thought to their monetary or social value. I think you should be able to look at a painting and appreciate it as it is and how it can connect with you. Sometimes it will be a painting, sometimes it will be a sketch, or a specific embroidery, or sculpture, or performance. Art exists in so many forms, and it is to restrict the definition of art to confine it only to the classical forms of art. However, it would be naive to believe that this is the only way that people relate to art, and there is no denying its function as a status symbol. A function of showing where one belongs in the social hierarchy. When it comes to status, as W. David Marsh says in his excellent book, Status and Culture, status is something that is bestowed upon another one. So for someone to benefit socially from owning or commissioning an expensive piece of art, it must be generally known how much the work of art is worth and who is the owner. And the more exclusive things are, the more status they give. Patronage used to be a mean that the rich and famous would take as a way to assert their culture and taste. And even though it is sometimes about the art, it was mostly about the fact that they could show off that they had the money to afford to patron and finance an artist. And so art became a status symbol, which it is, when the art costs several million of dollars to buy. There is no way it is only about the art, but about what it says, about the owner's place in society, about their power and wealth and their good taste. When you think about it, expensive works of art have always been an efficient shorthand for a powerful show of status, from the expensive portraits and ornaments that people were commissioning of themselves in full costumed regalia in the Western aristocracy, at a time where the simple art of being able to dress in such expensive and refined clothing was reserved to the ultra-rich, to the white and chrome penthouse in which is hung one gigantic painting in the center of the wall, a single painting that you immediately knows costs more than what you would be able to save in your entire life. In those paintings, both the content and the context of the object in itself can be a sign of status. The work of art, and by that I mean the content of the piece, can be a very ostentatious display of wealth, whether it shows a king decked in his most expensive outfit, surrounded with pieces of art, a few hounds, and scientific objects, or the gigantic castle painted in the background, or the object in itself, the painting. This was a detailed depiction of how rich and powerful the person was. These subtleties and intricacies of visual literacy might have gotten lost in translation in some ways, because it is important to remember that the past is in effect simply a foreign country, as the title of the book by David Lowenthal explains it. And I know I think I might have already mentioned this book before, so please forgive me the repetition if you have heard about it. However, it is very helpful to consider when trying to discern the visual representations of social status in the past. Understanding their symbols of status would be akin to understanding a completely foreign culture with its own language, societal norms, and ideas. The same way when we see a specific style of clothing or a certain brand or watch or shoes. And we know instantly that this signifies wealth and a certain rank in life. Even though I have to admit that these ideas and the way wealth and status are understood in the 2020s are constantly shifting and changing, and especially because the appearance of wealth and status are becoming more accessible to people. For example, you see people renting private jets in order to post this picture on social media without ever having flown these planes. All of these to say that the symbols of status that we find in works of art of yesteryear might not always be intuitive to us, but contemporaries who would have seen it would have understood exactly what that meant and what that show of power would have communicated to other people. Visual literacy is about looking at something, and not only a work of art, even though that can definitely be part of it. It can be a painting, a graphic novel, or also an advertisement, the design of a website. It is about the way something looks and what that conveys to you. It is about being able to understand what an advertisement is trying to communicate to you, and thus being less susceptible to be swayed by that same advertisement. It's about looking at the page of a comic without any text, and understanding the emotional narrative of that image. In a digital world where images are being constantly shown and bombarded to us, being able to understand them and being able to read those images is absolutely paramount. The monetary value of art is something that is very difficult to ascertain, because on one hand, there is the affirmation that art is priceless. But also putting a price tag on the value of art is a weird process, to be sure. And so the peculiar and nebulous rules of the elite world of fine arts, which are ever-changing and kept well under wraps to outsiders, definitely are created with an exclusionary view in mind. First of all, what distinguishes art, with like big air quotes around it, from more commercial artistic and creative ventures such as design, whether in terms of designing a house, a garment, or a poster, or even from craftsmanship such as embroidery, ceramics. After all of them are creative endeavors with equal merits. Why are some works of art priced the same way you would price an employee? For example, if you get a simple commission from an illustrator, usually priced at a flat rate that considers how much time and effort has been put into the piece, and meanwhile some pieces created in the same vein are priced in the millions and millions of dollars. The process of evaluating and assigning a number to these works of art is called appraising, which considers different factors such as the rarity, scarcity, the general canon of art of that artist, and its place within the grand timeline of art history. Popularity and the social capital of the artist or that particular piece will also be an important criteria. And so, they consider all of these elements and more to put a value to a piece of art. However, these type of appraisals are very finicky and subject to change very quickly. I mean, how often can an artist get embroiled in a candle or say something that will diminish their social capital, and suddenly no one wants to buy a piece from them. I think this is generally called being cancelled. Maybe. First of all, I think it is pertinent to explore the idea of what is art? I mean, I feel like this is maybe a tall order for a short podcast episode, but it is still maybe pertinent to think about it a bit before we get into the art phase. So what made the original ones art? And are forgeries able to be considered as real art? After all, it takes a good amount of technical talent to reproduce certain pieces of fine art in a way that is imperceptible to the naked eye. And yet, one of them is a genuine piece of art, and the other is merely a simple copy of it. And so copies are an incredibly important part of the world of art, and even more so in an age of mechanical and digital reproduction. As per our very good friend Walter Benjamin and his essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And so let's dig a bit into the philosophy of copies. In ancient art, the original artist of a work of art was not as important as it is now. Throughout the year, the cult of the artist became a subcategory for the cult of celebrity. And we assume that this is just how things have always been. However, it is not the case. During the antiquity, for example, the people who were making the statues were not the ones that were remembered and valued, and their work was not singular. Statues, or maybe tapestries even, were made to be copied and copied again, and this process did not diminish the inherent value of the art. So I think it is safe to say that we can distinguish at least two distinct types of copies. Ones that are being made with the deliberate intention of being passed as the original work of art, and the copy that is simply a replica of something else. For example, I have a small frame of a Monet painting in my room that I've thrifted, but I have no illusion about it being the real one. I think this can be compared to the way, maybe, our understanding of art functions now with our digital world, and the reproduction of art and its endless copies due to printing. But mainly due to the internet and our tools of mass communication. Does it affect the monetary worth of a painting when you can view a high quality image of that same painting whenever you wish to? Our understanding in itself of what is art has changed throughout the ages, expanding and constricting as the perception of what a work of art can be has evolved with the culture. Therefore, the cult of the artist is something that is fairly new in the art history timeline. They used to be perceived more as craftsmen. There were, of course, certain figures of art that were hugely influential. But artists were hired and had the patronage of rich and powerful people who had an interest in art, or an interest in looking like they had an interest in art. Successful artists had a whole crew of assistants and helpers, so truly how much of the art was created by that one person? And how do you really pinpoint one person as being the sole artist in these circumstances if it is a collaborative effort. It's the same way with movies. People credit the movie as being the sole creation and oeuvre of the director, but it is the ultimate collaborative creative effort, with everyone bringing their efforts and skills into it. No movie can be done by a single person, the director, the writer, sure, but also the costume maker, the director of photography, and it is also the actors and the cameraman. And it is these tensions between every players that make the work what it is. In the Renaissance, with Vasari's Lives of the Artist, which is often considered the beginning of what we now know as art history, and most importantly, of the way we think about the artist. This book is, well, you have to understand that art history and history in general, being thought of as an objective kind of discipline where the facts and the dates are extremely important, is very recent. For a long time, history was more or less used as a tool of propaganda or myth-making and should be taken with a grain of salt when it comes to their historical accuracy the further you go back. They would sometimes weave actual facts with legends and rumors and sometimes just straight up lie, because why not? It was more about telling a good story rather than record the true facts on paper. And you know, sometimes when we have those movies or books that are works of fiction but start with like, this work of art is inspired by real life, or this is a true life story, so who knows if someone finds one of these movies in 300 years and is like, oh my god, this happened. You know what I mean? So, a little grain of salt. And so, to go back to Vasari and his Lives of the Artist, it was one of the first time the focus was on the artist and their works. There are so many things that we consider as immutable and fixed in stone, and they are not. Our understanding of art and art history is definitely particular to our very specific moment in history. When you explore another era, this understanding of what is art and what is a copy will also shift, because the culture in itself will be different. The way art and copies were understood centuries ago was not the same as now. There was not the same inherent value in the original work of art. It is sometimes easy to forget how things that seem so obvious to us are only a social construct. They are this way because we have decided it would be this way as a society. Over years and over decades and centuries. When it comes to Roman and Greek statues, they are an example of how copies can be an intrinsic part of the artistic process, to the point where 18th century art historians thought the Roman statues were Greek because they were extremely similar copies of ancient Greek statues. It was a conclusion they reached with the information they had during that era. And we are always drawing our conclusions from the knowledge we currently have. Maybe a new information will be dug up from the earth tomorrow, and that will shatter our entire knowledge of how the world functions. But until then, we do what we can with the information that we have. And hope future generations will hopefully laugh at us kindly when they wonder how we could ever have thought of that this or that would be true. And so the history of art and art copies is simply a history of the way art was understood and valued during a specific point in history. What is the purpose of a forgery versus the purpose of a copy? You might say that the two are one and the same, but not necessarily. Some artists will make copies and studies of works of masters of art, and that is a normal part of the process of learning how to become an artist. As long as you don't present the work of art as being your own, there is nothing wrong with that, in my opinion, in doing this, because emulating artists that you admire and see what parts of their art and their styles you want to make your own is truly simply a part of how you become a better artist and how you learn, both on a technical and creative level. However, that copy will simply be a copy. There is also general trends to consider, where artists created works in the style of a popular artist of the time as a way to make money. And while in a sense it was not a real copy, after all, they were not pretending to be Raphael or any other successful artist. They're simply copying maybe a general sense of style. And on the one hand, it lets some people have a sense of that sort of luxury that they couldn't afford without paying for the real thing. And on the other hand, sometimes artists appreciated this kind of homage because it cemented their personal style in the cultural zeitgeist of the time, but also within the historical narrative. It is a system of trends and styles, and so the inherent purpose of a copy is not necessarily a negative one. Even if a copy seems like an exact replica of another work of art, even on a formal and material level, they will not be the same. Indeed, even the best copy of a Renaissance master will have the impossibility to recreate the exact same pigments and canvas, because this one painting will have been created in the 16th century, and that one in the 21st century. And thus, no matter how exacting the copy will be, it will still be only a copy and a recreation, and will not have the same historical value. There is a show I watched a couple of seasons from, and which is the BBC show Fate or Fortune, where they investigate if the work of art of the episode is a forgery or the real deal. Art dealer and art historian Philip Mould and investigative journalist Fiona Bruce are teaming up to try to assess if a work of art is a real one. It is a fascinating show where they delve deep into not only the history of the artist, the artwork, and the context in which it might have been painted, but they also try and trace back the provenance of that painting. The provenance is one of the most important elements to be able to confirm or infirm the authenticity and value of an artifact, especially the older it gets. We need to be able to retrace the history of the painting, ideally, back to the original owner or to the artist. The provenance is not only needed, but primordial when it comes to attesting the legitimacy of a work of art. To prove, for example, as in one of the first episodes of Fatal Fortune, that this painting is very much a real Monet, despite that it is not present in the Catalogue Raisonné The catalogue raisonné is a complete inventory of all of the artwork of an individual artist. And so any work of art that would not be in the catalogue would then be deemed a fake. However, the team of investigators from the show had managed to retrace pretty strongly the history of that painting in a convincing enough way that you could definitely argue for it to be a real Monet. And yet, if the experts that are handling the catalogue raisonné do not agree with that conclusion, it can never be sold as a real Monet and thus will never get the astronomical sums to which the paintings of the artist are often sold. And so, in a way, it doesn't matter if it is a real Monet or not, because it could be, or maybe it's not. What is important is that we agree that it is, for it to be able to be sold at the prices Monet are often sold. And so if it is not admitted by the experts and leading authorities as one, then it cannot be considered as real and will only have the value of a copy. However, a forgery, unlike a copy, is created with the formal intent to deceive, to fool, and to extort money from people who believe that they have just paid for the genuine thing, which is different from a simple copy that has the intent of paying respect or simply to study a particular artist or movement. Truly, the intent to deceive as the object being a real one is a key part of what a forgery is. Of course, that is a crime. And I want to say that I do not support thievery and crime, and I will not condone it in any situation whatsoever. And this is the official Imaginarium podcast tagline. However, I have to say that the topic of forgeries and art theft is one that is kind of extremely fun, because even though it is a crime and can definitely hurt people, even if not the same way a violent crime would. But I just have to say that there is something about a good art heist that is always so satisfying to me, whether it's a real heist or a fictional one. I hugely recommend the movies How to Steal a Million in 1996, starring Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole, as well as the 1964 Top Capi. If you want a good dose of highly fashionable and highly fun art heist movies from the 60s, they are genuinely so enjoyable and immensely stylized, and I adore all of them. One of the art heists that is still captivating the imaginary of a lot of people, and I guess I should say mostly mine, is the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist of 1990, one of the largest art heists of all times, and how none of the artworks have been found, even though it has been more than 30 years. What happened was two men dressed as policemen entered the museum in the middle of the night, tied the security guards in the basement, and after almost an hour and a half in the museum, they left with 13 works of art, never to be seen again. Works of art by extremely well-known artists such as Rembrandt, Vermeer, and Manet, pieces that were already judged to be extremely valuable, but now will probably be even more so if they are ever recovered. One of the most compelling things to me when it comes to that museum is that the empty frames has still been left up in the museum as a tribute to these lost paintings. A heist can add value to a painting After all, it is truly only after the Mona Lisa got stolen in 1911 by Vincenzo Perugia. He claimed that he wanted to give the painting back to Italy. It took 2 years for the authorities to find the culprits and the painting again. The reason he took the Mona Lisa and not any other paintings was not because of its value, artistic, historic, or monetary, but because the Mona Lisa, as anyone who ever visits the Louvre can tell you, is a surprisingly small painting, and so it was easily carried away. And it is that notorious theft that made it so that this particular work of art got cemented in the cultural zeitgeist as a canonical work of art and stayed there. The Mona Lisa was a well-known painting before that. Leonardo da Vinci would always be one of the masters of the Renaissance after all. But it was this association with this crime and the high-profile coverage of the case that made it so popular. However, talking about copies and fakes, there are some theories that affirm that the current Mona Lisa is a fake, that during these 2 years where La Gioconda was out of the hands of the museum institution, someone made a really good copy of it and kept the real one. And so this story adds to the cultural fascination with the Mona Lisa. This painting is one of these extremely highly priced pieces of art, being approximately valued to an entire $860 million at times of writing this episode. After all, even the person who is the most uninterested about art could visually identify it and tell you that it was painted by Leonardo da Vinci. It is one of those paintings that is simply part of culture, in a way very few other pieces are, if any. After all, it's a work of art that has been parodied to the extreme, and that has also been analyzed and interpreted. I usually prefer to talk about lesser-known works of art history on this podcast, because, truly, what can I tell you about the Mona Lisa that hasn't been told ad nauseam by everyone else, after all? It is one of the most debated works of art out there. However, when it comes to understanding the world of art, the canon of art, and why these works of art can be so crucial to the understanding of culture, status, and society, I think we cannot ignore the Mona Lisa. Are art forgers also artists? After all, good forgers are extremely skilled and knowledgeable in art, but also art history. Their technical dexterity makes it so that the copy and the original are indistinguishable from the other. And so, do copies also have value, both in the artistic sense and the monetary sense? Or are they meaningless fabrication? In a world of extreme mass communication where I can look at an extremely good quality image of a work of art, what is the importance of the authentic art? Even if at first glance a work of art and its forgery look the same. After all, they are not. But how do we value the work of art and its copy? Is that value truly intrinsic, or is it a value given by our social and artistic capital that has been built over the years? However, a copy will only ever be that. You cannot replace personal and human creativity. And there is something about the artistic impulse and personal touch that cannot be replicated. Stories of heists and dramatic art robberies can feel very compelling. There is something about those crimes that feel democratizing in a way, in the sense that art should belong to the people and that stealing those extremely valuable works of art feels like stealing from the rich. And sometimes it is stealing from the rich. However, when it comes to stealing from museums and cultural public institutions, who you are actually stealing from is the public. And we will get to the museum as an institution later on during this episode. However, no matter its numerous issues, and they exist, they are a way in which art and culture are accessible, not only available to an elite circle of few people. And yet, no matter what, there is something about the museum heist that is so compelling and fun. I know I'm absolutely fascinated by histories of heists, but there's just something that feels so fictional to it, even when it's true. Because these stories are often stranger than fiction. After there is only to discover a little bit about Arthur Brand and Octave Durham, to fall into a rabbit hole of stories about thefts, secrets, and schemes that feel so entirely out of this world. And yet, Arthur Brand is a private art detective, specialized in retrieving stolen works of art, and he has a working partnership with Octave Durham, a former professional thief with two stolen Van Gogh in his arsenal, and they are now working to prevent art thefts from happening, as well as recovering stolen artworks and getting them back to their legitimate owners. The cases in which they have been embroiled are so extraordinary it defies credibility sometimes. And yet it seems that these are things that happen out there in the real world. First of all, I just want to say that the title of art detective is so extremely cool, and I am absolutely in love with the concept of people being specialized in getting back stolen art to museum institutions and even to their original countries as well. Arthur Brand advances that up to 10% of art pieces in museums are actually fake artwork, which is an absolute insane number of art pieces that this concerns, and this is only the pieces that are in actual institutions, and not considering the pieces in art galleries or bought by individuals who might not want to admit that they have purchased a fake to the cost of enormous sums of money. I have no idea how true this number is, but it is something to consider. When it comes to art thievery, though, we do have to give a slow clap to the most talented art thieves in the whole entire world. Because not only they are the ones who have stolen the most art and artifacts in history, but also, and that is the kicker, they did it legally. And this is a story of the best art thieves in the world, the British Empire. And so I'm talking, of course, about the British Museum, which houses the largest amount of stolen and looted goods in the entire world. To be fair to them, they're not the only ones. All colonial powers are thieves, but the dynamic duo of France and the United Kingdom are the chief colonizers, but they truly are not the only ones. Just quickly, I can also mention Belgium, Italy, Japan, the United States of America. There are lots of countries that were part of the imperialist machine. A lot of European countries wanted into the idea of having colonies in over the world. The globe became a giant chessboard of who could get the most territories and profit out of them. And colonized people were simply collateral damage to this territorial expansion. There is an important conversation that's being currently had about looting and stealing of priceless artifacts and from colonies and how those items should be given back to their original countries. However, the British Museum and Company are probably doing the equivalent of putting their fingers in their ears and pretending they can't hear you nor see you. But I do think that justice needs to be served, and these items should be given back, especially after they had been stolen in such terrible circumstances. And sometimes, people will take matters into their own hand. In 2009, there was an auction held by Christie's, in which two bronze sculptures that were looted from China in 1860 during the Second Opium War were being put for bidding. Now those two statues, the head of a rat and the head of a rabbit, were part of a sale of artifacts that were owned by Yves Saint Laurent, the French designer. And so, they were sold to the highest bidder, Cai Minzhao, for the enormous sum of 28 million euros. A sum that he refused to pay, saying that these objects were not Christie's to sell. As they were the property of China, as they were looted and stolen goods. These items did end up being donated back to China. However, this raises so many issues when it comes to historical artifacts and their provenance. In the spring of 2023, investigators seized 69 million worth of stolen artifacts bought by Met trustee Shelby White, which, let's just be honest, just as a headline and as a sentence, is enough to be absolutely bonkers. No, I think this is still an ongoing investigation. And so, very much allegedly, and news have said that, etc, etc, etc. However, the fact that she had this many looted artifacts in her home, 69 million worth of, nice, means either one of two things. As she was on the committee of acquisitions at the Met, either she does not know what she's talking about when it comes to acquiring artifacts and making sure you do not acquire looted or stolen pieces, which would be very damaging to the Metropolitan Museum, as it means that they have people sitting under committees of acquisition that are not qualified for that position, and are only there because they would have made sizable donations and have gained influence through those channels. And if she does not know what she's talking about, how many pieces did the Met acquire that are possibly looted or stolen artifacts? This is if she was indeed not aware of having bought, I repeat, that once again, $69 million of looted art. Nice. Which is, in my opinion, very unlikely, but this is my opinion. The other option is that she was aware and bought them purposefully, without caring that they were looted, and this would be a testimony of the lack of care about the iffy and often cruel provenance of those artifacts, and would look the other way and not do her due diligence to assess the origin of these pieces, only to be able to possess these works of art. As it stands, she says that the artifacts were bought by her husband while he was alive. I guess dead men truly can talk or defend themselves. No matter if she is guilty or innocent, I think the situation is not good for the Met either, because either they have put on their comedy an incompetent or a criminal. Fakes and forgeries have an intimate relationship with the colonial enterprise. The trafficking of relics and historical artifacts, as well as the counterfeiting of copies from colonial regions, was especially a problem in the 19th century, when imperialism and tourism in the colonies was at its peak. Personally, I think the colonizer kinda had it coming, but what do I know? Counterfeit ancient Egyptian bowls were sold to unsuspecting visitors who wanted to bring back home a taste of quote-unquote authentic history. So often the driving force of these copies and forgeries is very simple. It is only about money in the end. It is about simple profit. Art is extremely profitable, and people want to cash in without having to make the effort of actually sourcing the actual artifacts or by making actual art. However, this sort of fraudulent business, as much as it is, you know, very much a crime, is nowhere as impactful as the consequences of imperialist looting during the colonial project. The 19th century was a century of looting and stealing in non-Western countries by a lot of Western institutions. This is true of most imperialist powers, but I think even most slightly of the French and the English, whom, in the early modern era, had territories all across the globe, from the Americas, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and honestly at this point I have named the entirety of the world. There is a joke that goes like this. If the only reason the pyramids of Egypt are still where they are is because the English did not find a way to move them back home. It is funny, but I also think that it does have a ring of truth to it, considering that actual ceilings and walls and tiles were moved to the museums of the imperialist homelands, such as the zodiac ceiling of the Temple of Dendera. It is a ceiling more than 2,000 years old that showcases the exact night sky that people would have seen at that time. It was taken off from its rightful place with gunpowder and explosions during the 19th century, simply because the French decided that they wanted to take it, and everything that was coming from a non-Western country was fair game. They decided that France must have it. And it is this very entitled and colonialist attitude that still governs a lot of the way art history and museum curating has evolved. And so, there is no way to separate the museum from its role in the imperial machine. The art world and the art canon are, by design, tools of imperialism. I know this might sound far-fetched, but please stick with me while I try to explain. I know that a lot of people doing art history and being part of the broader spectrum of the art world are against our imperialism. After all, there has been so much progress and pushback within the field with the rise of post-colonial theory and decolonizing actions that are being taken in cultural institutions now. But you have to understand that the art canon, in a general manner. Functions. And the way art history as a discipline got established has to do with pushing a specific idea of art and culture that conforms to the ideals of white supremacy. Most of the artworks that are in the art canon, and by the art canon, I'm not saying that there is an official list out there that's like, here are the works of art that we consider as being part of the art canon, being ratified by an official council of arts or whatever. However, there is a general idea that's pretty established in the general culture of what are the works of art that everyone should know. It's a list that has grown organically through time and was reinforced by academia and culture. Is it even possible to truly decolonize an institution and a world whose every tenet has been constructed from an idea of colonialism and empire? After all, the entire institution from the ground up was built on an imperialist worldview. The concept in itself of art and of the art world can be a tool of imperialism, and it has often been. From propaganda to keeping the artifacts that do not belong to them. Saying you are decolonizing is very well and good. But words are just that, and unless actual acts follow, well, it is as good as the wind, and it doesn't mean much in the end. I don't know how we would go on to reform this system, because the way I see it, it needs to be entirely destroyed and built anew, because the basis itself of the system of art is based on imperialism and capitalism. The idea of a global art canon is often Western-centric and reductive, and does not consider the true reality of a world of art history. Even when people make a global world of art history, the emphasis is often put on Western works of art, with maybe a certain pieces of from non-Western arts as to make it complete. However, the construction of the world of art is one that is built upon an idea of white supremacy underlying the construction in itself of that canon. The concept of authenticity, copies, and value is a fraught one in art, and one that is constantly shifting as culture and the march of history progresses on. But what is certain is that with the current debates on artificial intelligence and the way it is used to steal from artists, this debate will be one that will continue to be extremely relevant in the culture. On this, my darling listeners, thank you for listening to this episode of Imaginarium. I hope it was fun, and we'll meet again at some point for a new episode and a new deep dive into a lesser known subject of art history and visual culture. As this is the last episode of this season, I will be taking a short break from the podcast until the next season is written. Until then, I will be probably on Substack, which, hi, I have started a Substack, and the link will be in the show notes. I do hope you support it and follow along. I will definitely try to publish it as often as I can within my schedule. Otherwise, if you like this podcast, please do talk about it about anyone that you think will like it. And as the YouTubers say, like and subscribe and give us a good rating if you liked it. I want to take this opportunity to thank my patrons. Meili, Chun-Li Capuchin-Wien, Sam Hurst, Natalie Slaggett, Jameson Hollyburg, Jack, Eminem, and Carter J. Kane. Thank you all for the support you give this podcast. It means the absolute world to me. As always, all of the relevant images will also be on all of our social platforms at imaginarium_pod on Instagram as well as on Twitter. This podcast was written, narrated, and produced by yours truly, Najah. On this, I wish you all a very lovely day, evening, or night, and I hope to see you again very, very soon.